From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a leader of the computer industry, Andrew Grove. He's CEO of Intel, the world's largest manufacturer of microprocessors, the brains of the personal computer. Yesterday, he gave the keynote address at COMDEX, the computer industry trade show, now underway in Las Vegas. Also, the flip side of the romance novel. We talk with Sigrid Nunez about her new novel, Naked Sleeper, the story of a woman who is seduced and rejected. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Fragments, a new memoir by Benjamin Wilkomirski about what it was like to be a four-year-old child in a death camp in Poland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, a leader of the computer industry, Andrew Grove. He's CEO of Intel, the world's largest manufacturer of microprocessors, the brains of the personal computer. Yesterday, he gave the keynote address at COMDEX, the computer industry trade show now underway in Las Vegas. Also today, the flip side of romance. We talk with Sigrid Nunez about her new novel, Naked Sleeper, the story of a married woman who's flattered into having an affair. And Maureen Corrigan reviews Fragments, a new memoir by Benjamin Wilkomirski about what it was like to be a four-year-old child in a death camp in Poland. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United States has vetoed the re-election bid of United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali. It would have been a second term for him. Linda Fasulo reports from the UN.
The 14 other Security Council members registered their support for a second term for Boutros-Ghali in a resolution recommending his re-election by the General Assembly. But the U.S. vetoed the measure, as it had threatened to do for the past several months. Yesterday, Ambassador Madeleine Albright's spokesperson said she had received written instructions from Secretary of State Warren Christopher to block Boutros-Ghali's bid for re-election, saying Congress had lost confidence in the man and could hold back the $1.5 billion it owes the world body. After the vote today, Egypt's Ambassador Nabil El Arabi told reporters he would see if Boutros-Ghali wanted his name resubmitted in the next round of balloting when Africa's candidates are expected to be considered. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo at the UN.
The United States may not send troops to Zaire after all. Pentagon spokesman Ken Bacon says there's been a tentative decision to send military cargo planes and support teams instead of combat-ready troops.
We will concentrate on sending Air Force teams to Entebbe in airfield in Uganda and to Kigali in Rwanda and possibly into Kenya as well to establish staging areas for bringing supplies into Rwanda.
Relief agencies will then distribute the aid to refugees. 500,000 refugees are now back in Rwanda. A final decision on what the International Relief Force will look like will come on Thursday. That's when several countries will meet in Stuttgart, Germany, to talk about the force intended for Central Africa. A wintry storm is blowing across the Pacific Northwest. Heavy rains in Oregon are blamed for at least 4 deaths. Heavy, wet snow is falling in the Seattle area. Steve Kruger of member station KPLU reports.
A powerful tropical storm that swept north from Oregon ran into cold air from Canada over western Washington state. The resulting snow has shut down several state highways south of Seattle, as well as all of the freeway express lanes. Most of the area's schools have either closed or reduced their schedules. To the south, in Oregon's Willamette Valley, rescue crews are hoping to recover the bodies of 3 women who were buried when a hillside collapsed on a home near the city of Roseburg. One man died in that incident, and police say the 3 missing women are presumed to be dead. Flooding is expected along many rivers in Oregon and southern Washington. The rain and snow are expected to continue across the region throughout the day. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Krueger in Seattle.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials are up almost 39 points at 6,385. This is NPR. The government is going to pay nearly $5 million to several victims of radiation experiments. Energy Secretary Hazel O'Leary is to announce the settlement today in New York. The agreement represents the final settlement in 12 of 18 human radiation experiment cases. Humans were injected with plutonium and uranium. One testing subject is still alive. The rest of the money will go to the families of 11 other people. The Parliament of Belarus today began impeachment proceedings against the country's president. It is the latest move in an escalating constitutional crisis in the former Soviet Republic. NPR's Annie Bowers reports from Minsk.
On Sunday, voters in Belarus will be asked to choose between two competing draft constitutions. The first, supported by President Alexander Lukashenko, would give him effective control over all major branches of government. The second, offered as a response by Parliament, basically eliminates the office of president. Western governments say Lukashenko is trying to seize dictatorial powers through the ballot box, which he denies. Yesterday, Lukashenko's own prime minister resigned in protest, joining parliament and the constitutional court in their opposition to the president. Parliamentary leaders have now gathered enough votes to begin the impeachment proceeding, which could remove the president temporarily, although they probably don't have the two-thirds majority to complete impeachment. At the same time, the two sides are meeting to try to find a last-minute compromise. I'm Andy Bowers in Minsk.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin is expected to leave the Kremlin hospital this week for a nearby health retreat. A Kremlin spokesman says the president has been taking walks and holding meetings at the hospital where he's recuperating from quintuple heart bypass surgery. Yeltsin met for more than an hour and a half today with Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin, but doctors say it will take several more weeks before he'll return to work full-time. Yeltsin's office has released pictures of the president, who appears to have lost some weight. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Fresh Air support comes from Rhino Records, producers of Stan Freberg's comic view of history, The United States of America, Volume 1, The Early Years, and the new Volume 2, The Middle Years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. COMDEX, the huge computer industry trade show, is underway in Las Vegas. Yesterday, Andrew Grove gave the keynote address in celebration of the 25th anniversary of the microprocessor, the brain of the personal computer. Grove is the president and CEO of Intel Corporation, the world's largest producer of microprocessors. They developed the fastest and most advanced computer chip, the Pentium. Intel's alliance with Microsoft has made Grove one of the most powerful and wealthiest players in the computer industry. Grove has written several books about business management. His latest is Only the Paranoid Survive. Grove grew up in Hungary, survived the Nazis, fled the communists in 1956, and emigrated to the U.S. He joined Intel the year it was founded, 1968, and they soon became pioneers of another building block of the computer revolution, the memory chip. But in the 80s, Intel was forced into a new direction after going head-to-head with Japanese competitors who underpriced Intel. I asked Grove about the Japanese tactics.
Simply put, they were very big, much, much bigger than any of the American players at the time. And they had economies of scale that they could bring to the party. They had deep pockets. And generally, over many, many years, since they were all older than the American companies, they have perfected a manufacturing philosophy and a manufacturing technique that allowed them to build these things at a lower cost. But even when the costs, manufacturing costs, weren't lower, they were able to subsidize the early stages of their entrance into the memory field out of their other businesses. That's where size came in to the rescue.
At some point, you decided to give up competing with the Japanese on the memory chips, and you moved into microprocessors. How did you decide to do that? What was that turning point for you?
We have to put this in the context of some very difficult business conditions that we had in the mid-80s. We had lost a lot of market share. We were down to a small percentage of the memory chip market already. But we continued to invest in research and development and various support functions as if we were still a major player. So there was kind of a dissonance between what we actually were doing and what we, in our minds, we pictured we were doing. The consequence of this dissonance was we were losing a lot of money, and nothing on the horizon was going to reverse this. So that was kind of the context. Now, the question I would ask in retrospect is why we didn't make the decision to get out earlier, because the scenario I just described is not very good. And given that nothing is going to make it a lot better, why pour more resources and why pour more money after what we had already poured in? And the answer to that is that our whole concept of who we were was completely tied up with memory chips. We started the memory chip business. We were the first and in our minds still the best. And we had a real hard time dealing with a reality that was different than what we thought of ourselves. So there was this friction between the market realities and the financial realities and our self-perception. And eventually we had to face the market realities and had to act on it, and it was extremely hard.
I want you to explain the difference between memory chips, what Intel's success was based on, and microprocessors, what your success is based on now.
Memory chips are, by and large, all alike. Computer memory is made up of a bunch of chips, and you can buy those chips from one manufacturer or another, and they are basically interchangeable. Microprocessors have the equivalent of software built into the silicon chip. They are quite unique, and there's a whole lot of intellectual property involved in that software that you put into the chip. Some of it is called microcode, so even the word suggests that you build software into the silicon. So it is different in terms of content, but both chips are built by the same type of factories, using the same type of processes. So the difference is in the design of the chips. And to build microprocessor chips, to design microprocessor chips, you have to have expertise beyond what you have in the memory chip business, because you have to have the capability of capturing the software content and reducing it into bits and bytes on this little silicon chip. So it's difficult in a more difficult in a design way. It is very similar in a manufacturing way.
Now, when Intel moved from memory chips to microprocessors, was the computer industry changing around you at the same time?
Yes, it was, actually. Personal computers were coming on stronger and stronger, and there's still a minority of the computing world, but no longer a fringe phenomenon. They were kind of, to use that famous phrase, they were beginning to get respect. And the shift in our emphasis was very timely from the standpoint we made that shift as personal computers were taking off in significance, in numbers. So we got on a growth curve with this shift in emphasis.
A lot of Intel's success is a function of having combined powers with IBM and with Bill Gates's company, Microsoft, with their Windows operating system. And in fact, people use the word Wintel now to talk about that combined power of the Windows operating system and the Intel processing chip. How did you decide to enter into these alliances? Did it at first seem counterintuitive that you should just be off on your own and not entering into an alliance with somebody who at another time might seem more like a competitor than an ally?
Fairly early in the process of becoming a significant supplier to the personal computer industry, we realized that the structure of the industry, the personal computer industry, is shaping up differently than the structure of the classical mainframe mini computer industry. In the mainframe minicomputer industry, a company made all the pieces of what it took to make a product. They built their chips, they built their computers, they built their software, and then they had their own sales force selling all of that to the consumer. This new PC-based computing industry was a much more horizontal industry where people specialized in certain layers of that. We specialized in microprocessors. Microsoft specialized in the operating system in the computers. And the Compaqs and the IBMs of the world build the computers. And then the computers are sold by third parties, you know, the retail chains, resellers, value-added resellers, distributors. There is no single company that has all of the pieces. In this horizontal industry structure, we are all tied together in this invisible chain. So once you realize it, you make it work, and it doesn't mean that you don't have differences with these other people, but you also realize that the only way any of you can build a product that's useful to somebody is in joint arrangements with quite a number of other people.
I'm interested in seeing what you see when you look ahead into the near future. What are some of the things that you think we'll be using the internet for that we're not using it for yet?
Well, given that you asked this, I have been looking for an opportunity to correct way you characterize what I'm writing about, if you don't mind.
Go ahead.
You have described what I write about is that I write about the computer industry, and I don't look at it that way. I write about what I write about, and particularly this world of connected computers, internet-based communications, all mushed together, is going to be the foundation for all commercial and industrial activity that has, including activities that have nothing whatsoever to do with computers in the first place. You're going to see this picture for a moment, step back, and what we are talking about is fairly simple. Lots of computers everywhere, workplace, at home, schools, all of those computers connected to a network that allows them to reach into the files and the storage and the processing capabilities of any other computer in the world. That's what we're talking about. Once you have this capability largely in existence, commerce will be done in a very different way than it's done today. I think this phenomenon is so big, it is going to affect just about everybody and everybody's work in the next decade or so.
Andrew Grove is my guest. He's the president of the Intel Corporation and author of a new book about his business practices called Only the Paranoid Survive. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Andrew Grove. He's written a new book called Only the Paranoid Survive, and he's the president of Intel Corporation. Those of us who are lucky enough to be already hooked up to the internet can use it now to access information, to buy things, to communicate via email with other people. Are there applications of the internet that we don't have now that you could see in the near future? New things that we haven't even thought of yet.
I have two areas that I think are major problems for our society that this world of connected computers, internet-connected computers, have a potentially very large impact on. Mm-hmm. One is healthcare, the other is education. Very many instances when you talk with a medical personnel, that medical personnel is going to take your symptoms and look for information, often in a professional database, to come up with an answer. If you will be able to do that yourself, that the same care that you get today can be made available to many, many more people very, very economically. Now, go a step further and put into that, suppose this connection is going to be robust enough and those computers on the two ends are going to be powerful enough that you can do this at the same time showing your medical records, your x-rays, your MRI scans, and have a discussion with a person whose image, sound is on the computer, almost lifelike, in an almost like lifelike way. That says that you will be able to access specialists regardless of distance.
In other words, you can like show a doctor who's seven states away your rash. they can see your rash on video, diagnose it, and give you a prognosis and a prescription. Is that what you're saying?
And the doctor will be able to direct a microscope on your skin and see the image electronically on his screen exactly as he would see it in a microscope if you were in there. And possibly if something needs to be done on the other end, a much less trained individual can do the job and feed it into the computer for the evaluation of the specialist. The spreading of specialized knowledge through this network computer universe is going to be so much more effective than it is today. You will be able to leverage the knowledge of specialists, of whom there is only a few, to large masses of people. So and this comes at a time when the whole economics of healthcare delivery are in a crisis state.
Right, right. What would you most like your computer to be able to do for you that it can't do yet?
I would like this way of doing conferencing, telephone and video conferencing with larger number of people. Right now we can do it with 24 users, but it's pretty complicated, even that. I would like it to be very simple as making a phone call, and I would like it to be available everywhere to both personally, my family, and work-wise. And to some extent, I'm down the way because work-wise, I, in fact, use this technique to communicate with a lot of employees, sometimes dozens of them at a time, and sometimes with the aid of a big screen on the other end with large groups. So I have experienced this, and it is wonderful because what it saves is having to get on planes and travel and spend hours and hours and hours of wasted overhead to do a one-hour session at the end of that. I'm able to do the one-hour session in an hour. I'd like to see this more widespread, more commonplace. I think it is going to have a real impact on actually almost the reverse of what people expect. It will bring us into contact with each other in a more realistic way than we are able to do today.
Andrew Grove is my guest. He's the president of Intel, the microprocessing manufacturer, and the author of a new book called Only the Paranoid Survive, in which he shares some of the things he's learned in his many years in business. You're described as one of a handful of people responsible for transforming the computer into a cultural phenomenon. I wonder what the computer industry looked like when you first got into it.
It was monolithic, very, very serious. Computers were in highly secure dungeons, highly air-conditioned dungeons, I might add. They were very cold in more ways than one, both thermally cold and culturally cold.
This is when the computer took up the whole room.
Right, big rooms. It was not very broadly available to people. And the computer companies were conservative, very meticulous, and very professionally serious in a way that is the opposite of being accessible and customer-friendly to an ordinary person. I don't think it was an accident that when Apple started, they called themselves Apple Computer, because I think they wanted to punch through this dreadful seriousness that surrounded the computer industry as it existed up to that time. And I remember, so happens, my first reaction when I got a call from somebody at Apple who I happened to know, and I picked up the pink slip that says, you know, the while you were out, so-and-so called from Apple Computer, and I looked at my secretary and I said, Apple Computer, what the hell is that? And I laughed. And that's exactly the effect that I wanted to do. And that was the beginning of a transformation of the computer industry to a much more accessible, much more people-oriented, much more consumer-oriented, much more fun in terms of product industry.
What was your first impulse to get with that change or to resist it? To think it was a bunch of, you know, crazy kids who would come to no good?
I thought they were a bunch of crazy kids. I didn't get it for quite a while, to use today's terminology for that.
What changed your mind?
What changed my mind? Reality. I went to went to trade shows, and when I watched early trade shows, this masses of people glued to their computers, glued to the computer screen all around, and I found out that they were not computer professionals. You know, I was just talking to some people. They were all kinds of people from all walks of life who were just into this stuff. I started to scratch my head. There's something to this stuff. This is not a toy. This is a phenomenon.
You've, by anybody's measure, done pretty good for yourself. You know, you've built Intel. It's the king of microprocessing. It's been at the top for really many years. Is it important to you to stay number one? I mean, at this point, you've achieved so much. You're a wealthy man. You can get out now and be perfectly comfortable and feel real successful for the rest of your life. I mean, how much does staying on top mean to you? And if it means a lot, what's your motivation? Why stay in this competitive, constantly changing environment?
Because it's interesting. It's very, very interesting. Let me go back to, you used the phrase staying on top a couple of times.
Mm-hmm.
Staying on top, what that means to me is being in a position to have a measure of influence on shaping the future. You know, I have certain beliefs, and the people I work with have certain beliefs of what this future might look like, and some of it we touched upon, some of the good that it can bring. But we are looking on the insides of it, what we might do with our technology and other people's technology to make this kind of thing happen. It's very, very exciting. And you need to be a significant factor to have a significant influence on bring these things about. So, frankly, what gets me to work every day this morning is not staying on top, but putting another brick in place to building a different future for computing and for the use of computing by large numbers of people all around the world. That's very exciting stuff.
Andrew Grove is president and CEO of Intel Corporation. His new book is called Only the Paranoid Survive. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with Andrew Grove, president of Intel, about his life in Hungary before he emigrated to the U.S. Also, we meet novelist Sigrid Nunes. Her new book looks at the flip side of romance. And Maureen Carrigan reviews Fragments, the new memoir about a childhood in a Nazi death camp. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Andrew Grove, the CEO of Intel Corporation, the largest manufacturer of microprocessors, the brains of the personal computer. Yesterday, he gave the keynote address at COMDEX, the huge computer industry trade show now underway in Las Vegas. He's also written a new book about navigating through the changes of the computer industry called Only the Paranoid Survive. I know, and I mention this because I know it's been public, that you had prostate cancer. And a lot of people who get very sick find that their priorities change, their values change. I'm wondering if your priorities in terms of business changed, or if its relative importance in your life changed.
Not really. I mean, during the period of time that I was dealing with it, obviously my priorities shifted, and the first task every day for me was to do whatever I needed to do to find out more about the disease and find out, understand my options, and then go about and have the treatment. And with the treatment behind me, I'm kind of back to normal. Of course, you know, God forbid, should the disease come back, you know, all bets are off again. But I certainly am not inclined to sit around and suspend the rest of my life kind of half expecting that something like that might happen.
You grew up in Hungary during World War II, and I'm wondering how your family was affected. Are you Jewish?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Did you have to hide during the war?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Was your whole family successful in hiding, or did you have family that was
discovered? I don't want to get into the details of it, but some of my family survived and others didn't.
Right. Then you were one of the people who, after managing to survive the Nazis, then Stalin invaded Hungary, and then you were stuck with communism.
Mm-hmm.
You came to the States in 1956, I believe, at the age of 20. What made you decide to make that leap?
Well, you know, the dangers involved with escaping Hungary were about equal the dangers of staying in Hungary. Hungary was a pretty sad place in 1956, and there were pretty strong rumors about people being picked up on the, people my age being picked up on the street and herded away, and I thought it was a good time to make a run for it.
Was it hard to get out?
In retrospect, it was just medium hard, but there was no way to know what it was going to be like. So when we left, a friend of mine and I left Budapest. We had no idea what was going to happen near the border. You know, there was no internet in which there was a homepage that somebody could tell us the border conditions of the day. In fact, there was absolutely no information coming out of it. So we expected actually probably a rougher crossing than we actually had, but it wasn't easy.
And little did you know, huh, that you were leaving communism to become one of the most successful business people in the world.
Well, no, that was not on the radar screen for me. I just wanted to get out and somehow get back into school and continue with my education.
The alliance of your company, Intel, and Microsoft is really like dominating the computer world right now. I mean, there is competition, but you've really got a big grip on the market. Now, you know, your book is called Only the Paranoid Survive. You know, change is brought about because you're forced to change. Do you feel like that it's risky in a way to become too successful because you can become complacent?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the beginning of the end of every major institution is to be so successful and so unthreatened that you stop driving yourself forward.
I have one last question for you. What do you use your computer for now on a typical day?
That's a good question, actually. My use of a computer is almost 100% communications-oriented. The predominant use is for electronic mail. I use electronic mail as an extension of my day and my communication techniques and my management style. And I reach a lot of people, and a lot of people reach me with it really 7 days a week. Now, I don't want to say 24 hours a day because I obviously don't read my email when I sleep, but sometimes it seems like it.
Sure.
So that is the prime application. I do use online services, new services, the World Wide Web for keeping up with news, particularly news having to do with our industry. So general information database searches would be the second use. And the third one is we have a product that allows video conferencing to take place on a personal computer. So I have a little camera on my personal computer and any other personal computer that's equipped with it. I can have video conferencing as well as share data. I use that to communicate either with individuals or with groups on the other end. So those are the three major applications that I do.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very much, Terry.
Andrew Grove is CEO of Intel Corporation and author of the new book, Only the Paranoid Survive. Due to recent formations of Children of the Holocaust societies in Poland and the U.S., several hundred child survivors have come forward to tell their stories. As young children liberated from the camps, they were furnished with false names and papers, which protected them from anti-Semitism and, in some cases, from being labeled stateless persons. Benjamin Wilkomirski, a musician living in Switzerland, is one of these self-described children without identity. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review of his memoir, Fragments.
You can't read Benjamin Wilkomirski's Holocaust memoir, Fragments, without getting hung up on questions like, where was Wilkomirski born? Who were his parents? Is Benjamin Wilkomirski his real name? And did his mother and brothers die in the concentration camps? It's pointless to ask these questions because Wilkomirski's extraordinary little book explores what it's like to exist without a knowledge of one's own origins. Instead, what he possesses are memories that don't make sense and so defy our desire for logical narrative order. In his first chapter, Wilkomirski warns that his early recollections are a rubble field of isolated images and events, shards of memory with hard, knife-sharp edges, which still cut flesh if touched today. As we readers gingerly step through Wilkomirski's jumbled, jagged past, We bloody ourselves in the process. Wilkomirski thinks he was 3 or 4 years old when he arrived in a Nazi death camp in Poland. The older children who shared his crowded barracks told him that the world beyond the camp's outer fence had disappeared and that such creatures as mothers no longer existed. All the evidence suggested they were right. In stark, disconnected stories that recapture his child's eye view, Wilkomirski describes growing up in a fairy tale written by Kafka, a fairy tale in which the wicked witch triumphs. The punishment in this world for simple childhood infractions is death. That's why, even though most of the children in the camp suffer from diarrhea, they quickly learn to restrain themselves. A new kid who soils his straw pallet one night is dragged from the barracks by the SS, never to be seen again. Another memory. One rare day, Wilkomirski and some other children are playing catch outside with a wooden ball. A guard joins in their game. "Me, me, give it to me," yells a little boy. And so the guard lifts his thick arm and slams the wooden ball into the boy's skull. Adults make the rules. Children suffer the consequences. That's the way the world is. And that air of acceptance is what sets Fragments apart from the other Holocaust memoirs I've read. Because Wilkomirski came to consciousness in the camps, he doesn't realize that life there is an insane departure from the norm. Rather, since it's the only life he's ever known, it becomes his blueprint for interpreting the outside world after he's liberated. As he says, "No one ever told me that the old times and their evil games and rules were over, and I could go forward without fear or threat into a new time and a new world." Consequently, upon arriving at his Swiss foster parents' home, Wilkomirski sees the furnace in their basement and becomes convinced he's fallen into a lethal trap. On a school ski outing, he and another child survivor stop in their tracks, terrified when they spot the ski lift. "The death machine," they murmur to each other. One of the disturbing achievements of this book is that it makes you understand how Wilkomirski can say, after the experience of the camps, that school was the beginning of a bad time. The other children there jeer at him. The adults sternly order him not to speak of the camps. In response, Wilkomirski yearns to return to his barracks, where, he says, "I belonged." In his afterword, Wilkomirski writes that, "I grew up and became an adult in a time and in a society that didn't want to listen." As much as it serves as another witness to the horrors of the Holocaust, Fragments also testifies to the immorality of belittling children's memories or dismissing their current fears. After reading Fragments, you'll know better than to ever say to a child waking from a nightmare, "Just forget it."
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Fragments, a memoir by Benjamin Wilkomirski. Coming up, a talk with novelist Sigrid Nunez, whose latest novel is about being seduced and rejected. This is Fresh Air. Sigrid Nunez has written a new novel about being seduced and rejected. She writes, "One of the worst feelings in the world is the shuddering distaste that sets in when you have been intimate with someone and later regretted it." Nunez's new novel, Naked Sleeper, is her second book. Her first, A Feather on the Breath of God, was a semi-autobiographical novel about ethnic identity. Naked Sleeper follows the story of Nona, a woman who puts her happy marriage at risk when she has an affair with a man she meets in an artist's retreat. She doesn't intend to see him after she returns home, but he overpowers her with a stream of passionate love letters and desperate invitations to come see him. She's seduced by his passion, flies out to see him, only to find that everything about her seems to irritate him. In this scene, she's lying in bed with him, sleepless.
In the ridiculous king-sized canopied bed, Nona lay as far from her lover as she could. His snoring was light but enough to disturb her. Who thinks to bring earplugs to a tryst? Again, she thought of the poems Lyle had left on her bed that day, what he wanted to do to her, what he would do to her if he could. Letters. That little book into which he had poured out his heart, carried away not by love, but by the vocabulary of love, the adjectives and verbs of love, one smooth golden word following another, like honey dripping from a spoon. She had accomplished nothing by coming to Tucson except to destroy his fantasy, and for this he could not forgive her. It had been a lot of work, that fantasy. They had been together only a few hours, and he had succeeded in making her feel wholly undesirable, fat, smelly, food stuck to her mouth. It was her punishment.
Thank you for reading that excerpt of Naked Sleeper. You know, this affair really interests me. This character, who was seemingly very, very happily married, is almost flattered into having this affair. She's so won over by all the flattering language of this fella's love poems and his love letters. Do you think somebody can just be flattered into leaving a happy marriage for an affair?
Well, I think that someone can be flattered enough into making a mistake and having enough denial that he or she won't realize how much he or she is putting at risk. You know, that you only pay attention to what's happening right then because it's so exciting and promises adventure, and you don't really think about what the long-term consequences are going to be.
In this affair, the man has, you know, been so flattering in his love letters and in his poems, and he's created this fantasy person that she realizes when she goes to meet him that she can't possibly fulfill. But I get the impression she fell in love with the fantasy of her that he created.
Yes, I think that that probably is true. I think that it was a great pleasure for her to see herself through his eyes. You know, I think she looked younger, more beautiful, more romantic, and certainly sexier.
You know, it seems in a way that your novel is the flip side of the romance novel. You know?
Yes, that's been said to me by someone else.
Really? Yeah, because in the romance novel, you know, passion is ignited and the two people get together. And in this novel, passion is ignited and the two people get together, and it leaves her feeling like she has food stuck between her teeth, and then she looks funny and she doesn't measure up.
Well, the thing is that I sometimes think, well, you know, if you see popular movies and you know what's in these romance novels and you watch television or whatever, and you think, well, no wonder the divorce rate is so high. I mean, people have very wrong-headed ideas about love, romantic ideas about love and what constitutes adventure in love. And I think a lot of people are really misled about what romance is and what it can bring them. And I also think that for a lot of people, marriage is a temptation that for certain people would be better off resisting. Not everyone is cut out to be married and to have a family, but we've accepted in our culture that it really is for everybody or just about everybody. And, you know, it really doesn't work out that way. And I think that is why so many marriages fail.
Do you think your character's cut out for marriage? Do you think you're cut out for marriage?
Well, starting with the character, this is what she's trying to find out. I mean, she says herself that she isn't. That really is why, after she comes back from her fling with the other man, where she says, you see what I did here? I proved that I'm not cut out for marriage. Now, her husband is always trying to tell her that it isn't so. You know, as for myself, I suppose I could say now at this point that I was not cut out for marriage. I've never been married, and I'm not going to marry.
You can say that with real authority?
Yes.
Yes, how can you be so certain?
Well, there really isn't anything that I could have from a marriage that I don't already have. So you know that's really how I know. I mean, marriage couldn't bring me anything that I want. When I look at people who are married, they don't have something that I lack and want. Although I do know some happy marriages.
I know you've been to a couple of writers' colonies because you thank them in the credits.
Yes.
Some of your new novel is set in a writer's colony. In fact, it's at the writer's colony that your main character's affair begins, and some other affairs begin there as well. The writer's colony is supposed to be a work retreat so writers can get away from those troublesome details of day-to-day life and just write. But have you found that there's a lot of extracurricular stuff going on at writer's colonies?
Well, the place where Nona meets Lyle, where she goes away to work on her book, is actually quite different from a writer's colony. But it is, you know, I have been to artist colonies a couple of times. And I've always gotten, I've gotten some of my best work done there. They really are set up, they are ideal for work. And I know lots of artists who feel the same way. But they are, you know, these places, it's kind of like what you hear about movie sets. The people there are people who are taken out of their, you know, their everyday world and their, you know, their normal context. And it, you know, and they behave differently. I mean, that's one of the themes of my book. And you know, there is always some romance going on. And in fact, I know a number of people who met their spouses either at Yaddo or McDowell.
Do you know people who left their spouses because of lovers they met at the writers' colonies?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. It happens.
Huh.
There's still, I mean, still, you know, the main thing that gets done is work. But yeah, people fall in love and out of love and have affairs and flirtations and whatever. And also, let's not forget, make great friendships at these places.
Sigrid Nunes is my guest. Her new novel is called Naked Sleeper. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Sigrid Nunes, author of the new novel, Naked Sleeper. If Naked Sleeper is, in a way, the flip side of the romance novel, then your first novel, A Feather on the Breath of God, would be the flip side of the ethnic coming-of-age novel. Because, I mean, it's very much about your ethnic background, but your ethnic background is so unusual and you're so not a part of it in a way. You're so detached from it in a way. And by way of explanation, let me ask you to describe the background of your parents.
Well, my mother's German, and my father was half Chinese, half Panamanian. He was living as an illegal immigrant in Manhattan's Chinatown. He'd grown up, actually, in China. And the war broke out, and he was drafted, and he went over to Germany with the occupying forces, which is where he met my mother, and they ended up in the Fort Greene housing project in Brooklyn, New York, America.
So if your father was half Panamanian and half Chinese and your mother was German, what did you think of yourself as being?
My mother was really the dominant parent, and she wanted her children to be German. So I think when I was Growing up, I was sort of torn between those two identities, American, German. My father was very withdrawn and distant from the family. I didn't identify myself as a German, Chinese, Panamanian, American. And after a certain point, I just, actually quite young, I just thought of myself as an American or as like the kids around me.
You have characters in each of your novels who teach English to immigrants, which is something that you've done as well.
Mm-hmm, I have.
Do you feel like you've learned how strange the English language is, really is, by trying to teach it to people who don't know it?
Well, I've learned how difficult it is to learn, I've learned how different it is from, say, French and Italian, which are the two languages that I know. Mostly, though, teaching English as a second language has made me very, very shy about trying out my own foreign languages because, you know, because there are so many comical mistakes. And I always think of myself, you know, in Italy trying to get by and what crazy, terrible things are coming out of my mouth as I'm simply trying to say, you know, just does the train stop here?
Well, let me give some examples that you quote in one of your books. And this is examples of with the writing that the teacher gets from her students. As a teacher, I had intercourse with many children. My daughters are good wenches. I got married in 1982, and every year I had a daughter, and every other year I had a son. I have a grandson 2:30. It's so hard to explain what's wrong about those sentences to someone who doesn't understand English.
And you also, you learn how much damage, a dictionary can do.
Because exactly.
Of course, it's the you look up there, and you're looking for, you know, girl, and there's wench. And you think, wench, now that's an interesting word. I'll just, you know, my daughter is a good wench. You know, there's no room in the dictionary for long explanations about why that's not possible.
You describe immigrants speaking of the pain they feel when their children insist on speaking English only at home. Have you witnessed that a lot?
It happened all the time. I mean, these parents would say that they, you know, particularly with the younger children, they would have been here for like several months, let's say, and the parents' English would still be very, very bad, and the kids' English, what they were picking up at school and in the playground, was getting better and better. And the parents discovered that if they said something, you know, in their native tongue to the children would only answer in English, and it upset them. And you know, they didn't really understand it. I think it's partly a survival tactic. But what would happen, and this was something that, again, that happened a lot, is that you would have, if the children came over young enough, they would learn English and speak English very well, but they would not speak their native language. Now, the parents who came later never really acquired good English, but of course had their native tongue. So you had parents and children who didn't really share a common language. You know, it was the parents speaking, let's say, excellent Russian and no English, and the kids growing up to speak excellent English and only, you know, bits of Russian.
Isn't that
it's
the
a
kind
very
of
strange situation? No, not really, because my mother, although she had a very heavy accent, her English was excellent. My father's English was not good, but my mother spoke excellent English, read mostly in English, and had a great love for the language, and was always correcting our grammar and so on, and was actually quite appalled by how badly our neighbors spoke English, and even some of our teachers at school.
Sigrid Nunez is the author of the new novel, Naked Sleeper. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Tracy Tannenbaum, research assistance from Siobhan Roth. Annie Bacon is our intern. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Borders Books and Music, now featuring Dawn Upshaw's new CD of musical theater songs by Rodgers and Hart on Nonesuch Records. This is NPR, National Public Radio.